I hope the speaker has a better memory than myself. It is the third Epistle of John we've received this evening. I speak of the religion. My dear brothers and sisters, the darkness of the night outside and the inclemency of the conditions are in stark contrast to the glory and the light and the beauty of this epistle that we're going to look at together tonight. Indeed, we intend to split the work of considering this epistle into a general appraisal, first of all, during this first address. And then afterwards, God willing, we'll look at a more analytical approach, looking at it verse by verse. Well, a considerable amount of obscurity surrounds the circumstances of this epistle. The style and the content of the second and third epistles of John are typical of the author. In word, the content and the style of those words. The internal evidence, thus supporting the view that they were indeed written by the man that we know as the Apostle John. And both these epistles were written to individuals, although the individuals' names don't appear at the letterhead. Nonetheless, they were both written to individuals of note. Some have suggested that the second epistle was written to the ecclesias in general. This is from the word that we read in the first verse of that second epistle, the elder unto the elect lady and her children, whom I love in the truth. The elect lady, the bride of Christ. But we're not dealing with the second epistle of John tonight. The one before us, the third epistle, is written to Gaius, a believer well known for faith and for good works. And just how well known he was for faith and good works, brothers and sisters, we'll see as we progress through this epistle. And we notice as well that John describes him in the same words that Jesus did of John himself. He is the beloved. Let's turn first of all, brothers and sisters, shall we, to the Gospel of John. Let's look first of all at John chapter 13. John 13 and verse 23. This, of course, is the last Passover. Verse 23. Now there was leaning on Jesus' breast, or on Jesus' bosom, one of his disciples whom Jesus loved. Simon Peter therefore beckoned to him that he should ask who it should be of whom he spake. Notice then that there is this close association between Jesus and the disciple whom he loved. Jesus loved all his disciples. And John was described as the disciple whom he loved. Let's also look at chapter 19. John chapter 19 and at verse 26. When Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple whom standing by, whom he loved, he saith unto his mother, Woman, behold thy son. Then saith he to the disciple, Behold thy mother. And from that hour that disciple took her into his own home. That special relation, that association that Jesus had with John. And as we turn back into the third epistle, we notice that John describes the disciple Gaius in precisely the same terms. Verse 1, The elder unto the well-beloved Gaius, whom I love in the truth. We'll look at those words more specifically later as we proceed. But it's not easy to, as it were, to derive the circumstances of this epistle, because so little is apparent to us on the surface. It's not easy to see the circumstances behind its writing, but clearly they are late, and they're probably at a time when John had returned from Patmos and he has come back to view the apostate influences that are going on within the ecclesias. These apostate influences have indeed increased. The names which occur in the epistles, or this particular epistle, suggests a very strong link with the ecclesias of Asia and of Ephesus in particular. And this is, of course, is supported by secular evidence around the end of the first century. And also, we notice as well, brethren and sisters, that the idea of Ephesus would have a very strong connection with the apocalyptic vision which we believe John so recently has been granted when he was in Patmos. Remember, from history we know that John returned from Patmos, he was released where he had been exiled. And from where John sent out brethren. And it seems that the Apostle John has sent out a group of brethren on a missionary journey to another ecclesia. And maybe on account of the very influences that they encountered there, which are recorded of another member of this ecclesia to whom he is writing, Diotrephes. Gaius, brothers and sisters, was clearly of considerable influence within this ecclesia, and he was certainly a man of an extremely independent mind. But independent for the truth's sake. And another leading figure, and an equally influential member, alas, a man jealous and proud, who was not slack to take the opportunity of defying an apostle, rejecting his authority. Let's read verse 10. Wherefore, if I come, I will remember his deeds which he doeth, prating against us with malicious words, and not content therewith, neither doth he himself receive the brethren, and forbiddeth them that would, and casteth them out of the ecclesia. Rejecting his authority. That was indeed Diotrephes. And John, if John was the only remaining apostle at this time, and it is late, brethren and sisters, and it seems likely that he was, if he is the last remaining apostle, then he is indeed himself a very exalted figure amongst the ecclesias on that account alone. And remember, he had seen Jesus. In John's gospel record, he had seen Jesus baptized. He had seen the Holy Spirit like a dove descending upon him. He had seen his ministry. He had been with him during his ministry. He had seen him betrayed. John had seen him have a mockery of a trial when he went in to the high priest's house where the trial took place. He has seen him spat upon and scourged. He has seen him taken to the place of a skull and crucified. He saw the place where his body was lain. He has seen him raised from the dead. He has spoken to him. And he has seen him ascend on high. And above all, brothers and sisters, it was the Apostle John that was granted the privilege of receiving the greatest prophecy in the New Testament. Diotrephes heaped insults, therefore, upon this visiting delegation from John, and threatens to cast out of the ecclesia, excommunicate, withdraw from any brother or sister who showed kindness or common courtesy or the mercy of Christ to those whom he sent. Let's turn back, brothers and sisters, to the Gospel of Matthew, and we'll look at chapter 20 to start with. Matthew chapter 20. Verse 25. But Jesus called them unto him and said, Ye know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them. But it shall not be so among you, but whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. And whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. But not so Diotrephes. Those visiting brethren were rejected with malice, who came in the name of the Apostle John to minister their spiritual well-being to that ecclesia. Let's turn back in Matthew to chapter 10. Verse 40. He that receiveth you, receiveth me. He said to his disciples, he that receiveth me, receiveth him that sent me. He that receiveth a prophet in the name of a prophet shall receive a prophet's reward. And he that receiveth a righteous man in the name of a righteous man shall receive a righteous man's reward. And whosoever shall give to drink unto one of these little ones a cup of cold water only in the name of a disciple, verily I say unto you, he shall in no wise lose his reward. You know, brothers and sisters, Diotrephes denied the very principle of brotherly kindness to those who were sent formally by an apostle. He denied the very elements of brotherly kindness, not even the basic humanity. His bowels of mercies were lacking. He had no kindness. His contention with the brethren stemming from his grudge against the Apostle John. And this grudge against the Apostle John, it was born of pride, a determination to exalt himself above an apostle. And we've seen this in the ecclesias, brethren and sisters, not quite to the same extent, because there are no apostles amongst us. But we know the kind of thing, do we not? We've seen it in our ecclesias, brothers and sisters. I'm not going to listen to such and such a speaker. I am not having anything to do there. I'm not receiving him into my house or show him any hospitality because he didn't agree with me over such and such. And a schism has started within the ecclesia. And at this late stage, may we say, brethren and sisters, at this late stage in the development of the man image, those signs that we're seeing around us, almost walking by sight as well as by faith, at this late stage, it's not the time for schism. It's not the time, brethren and sisters, for private interpretation. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 25. Verse 31. When the Son of Man shall come in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory, and before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divideth his sheep from the goats, and he shall set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on his left. Then shall the king say unto those on his right hand, come ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was an hungered, and ye gave me meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me. And then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered, and fed thee, and thirsty, and gave thee drink? When saw we thee a stranger, and took thee in, or naked, and clothed thee? Or when saw we thee sick, or in prison, and came unto thee? And the king shall answer and say unto them, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these my brethren, ye have done it unto me. Those, brethren and sisters, are those in the Gaius class. And there were also those in the Diotrephes class. Verse 41. Then shall he say unto them on the left hand, depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was an hungered, and ye gave me no meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me not in. And ye naked, and ye clothed me not. Sick, and in prison, and ye visited me not. Then shall they also answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered, or a thirst, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister unto thee? Then shall he answer them, saying, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye did it not to one of the least of these, ye did it not unto me. And these shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into life everlasting. That's aeonian life of the future age. We can but hypothesize, brothers and sisters, of the fate of Diotrephes that's waiting for him at the coming tribunal of Christ. We don't judge him, we let the word and we let Christ do that for us. But the brethren were received, however, by Gaius, with the affection and the hospitality, becoming a disciple. They turned to him, you see, brothers and sisters, in a time of need, because they were ashamed to go outside the ecclesia for help. To have to turn to Gentiles and unbelievers was highly inexpedient in the circumstances generated by John sending these disciples to this other ecclesia. Let's turn back to the third epistle. Verse 7. Their circumstances were, verse 7, because that for his name's sake they went forth, taking nothing of the Gentiles. They went forth taking nothing of the Gentiles. They took nothing of them, brethren and sisters. And their only resource, which they carried with them, was an ample dispensation of the word of truth, which they were prepared to set before that ecclesia at the behest of John. For those among whom they went to labour, they had regard to preach the word, to strengthen them, relying on the principle that a workman is worthy of his hire. And in these verses, brothers and sisters, we're shown three classes of people. Note there, it says that they went forth taking nothing of the Gentiles. Notice those words there, Gentiles, because John is speaking of those that are outside the ecclesia as Gentiles. And the way he uses Gentiles here isn't an ethnic term. It's no racial element at all in it. It's entirely spiritual. Those without are Gentiles. And we that are not sinners of the Gentiles, Paul says. We are not of the Gentiles. We are of the seed of Abraham. If truly we are no longer aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers from the covenants of promise. But these three classes, verse 5, beloved, thou doest faithfully whatsoever thou doest to the brethren and to strangers. And then we have in verse 7, taking nothing of the Gentiles. What does he mean there? To brethren and to strangers. This well-being, this hospitality that Gaius showed to those visiting. Well, let's not confuse those two latter at all. Strangers were brethren. Strangers were brethren. But those who were personally unknown, being strangers to those parts. Verse 5, brothers and sisters, is not suggesting for one moment that Gaius performed charitable works to those outside the covenant. Even if he did out of common humanity, that's not what this verse is saying. He received the brethren, albeit strangers, with courtesy and kindness, especially those who were to minister about the word, labouring for their spiritual well-being at that ecclesia. Labouring that they might know the will of the Apostle John, that inspired apostle, that they might be built in their most holy faith. And you know what Paul said of the Galatians when they saw his need, when he, Paul, was sent to Galatia by the brethren at Antioch. Let's turn to Galatians chapter 4. Very similar circumstances that the Apostle Paul found himself in. Galatians chapter 4 and verse 13. Ye know how through infirmity of the flesh I preached the gospel unto you at the first, and my temptation which was in my flesh ye despised not, nor rejected, but received me as an angel of God, even as the anointed Jesus. Where is then the blessedness ye spake of? For I bear you record He bears testimony before them that if it had been possible, ye would have plucked out your own eyes and have given them to me. And there were also those in the Galatian ecclesia who likewise opposed Paul's position. Verse 16. Am I therefore become your enemy because I tell you the truth? They zealously affect you, but not well. Yea, they would exclude you that ye might affect them. And he's talking about the Judaizers that wish to be affected by them, that it may be seen that this despised doctrine of Christianity wasn't going to bring a whole lot of trouble upon the Jewish element. And therefore they tried to water it down. You see, there were those who bore a grudge in that Galatian ecclesia against the natural authority of those able to teach them according to the truth. That natural authority invested in an apostle. But to the faithful, he was as an angel of God. It was as an angel of God that Paul was among them. And so he wrote to the Hebrews, brethren and sisters, in chapter 13. Hebrews chapter 13. And verse 1. Let brotherly love continue. Be not forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. Remember them that are in bonds as bound with them, which suffer adversity, as being yourselves also in the body. Be not forgetful to entertain strangers. And we know that those strangers who he was thinking of that were those who came to Abraham when he sat in his tent and entertained three angels, one of whom bore the memorial name and knew not. And with that we'll come up again in the third epistle of John as we go through it. And so he's saying then, associate yourselves with good men. Then verse 3, associate yourselves with good men, and this by service one to another. Well, brothers and sisters, this third epistle was addressed to Gaius. Now this was a very common name. There were three men mentioned in apostolic times by the name Gaius. One is spoken of as a Macedonian. That's Acts chapter 19 and verse 29. There was also Gaius of Derbe, Acts 20 and verse 4. And there was also Gaius, mine host, who Paul mentioned with great affection in his letter to Rome. Let's turn to Romans chapter 16, brothers and sisters. Romans chapter 16, verse 23. Gaius, mine host, and of the whole ecclesia, saluteth you. Erastus, the chamberlain of the city, saluteth you, and Quartus, a brother. Notice there, Gaius, mine host, saluteth you, or Gaius, mine host, and of the whole ecclesia, saluteth you. It's a somewhat precarious hypothesis, brothers and sisters, to put it at its mildest, to associate Gaius of John's third epistle with one of these references. Just at face value, as this was clearly a very common name in the first century. And yet the trait of character seen in the third epistle of John fits, more than fits well, brothers and sisters. The circumstantial evidence, I think we'll see, is quite large to associate Gaius of the third epistle with Gaius, mine host. Both are generous, noble characters in the extreme. And this one here, especially described in Romans 16, he is mine host and of the whole ecclesia. Let's turn back to the third epistle, verse 5. It's read verse 5 again. Beloved, thou doest faithfully whatsoever thou doest to the brethren and to strangers which have borne witness of thy charity before the ecclesia. These verses tell us, one, that he was faithful in service to the household of faith, to the ecclesia, and to strangers. And secondly, it was testified of his charity, his agape. And note also, brothers and sisters, the play on the word beloved. He is the beloved that doest faithfully. We saw this in verse 1, the elder unto the well-beloved Gaius, and verse 6, which have borne witness of thy charity. Or we mean verse 11, brothers and sisters, beloved, follow not that which is evil. So he was beloved. Verse 1, we see the word agapito, well beloved. In verse 5, we see the word agapiti, beloved. And in verse 6, we see the word agape, thy charity before the ecclesia. Was it such a disciple then, brothers and sisters, with whom Paul lodged when he wrote the letter to Rome while at Corinth? Romans 16 tells us that he was hospitable not only to Paul, but also to the whole ecclesia. And so the selfish ambition and pride of the grudging and jealous Diocletus was counterbalanced by this lovely character, one touched by the meekness and the gentleness of Christ. And let's look at verse 6 again, a literal rendering here. His love, agape, was in the presence of the ecclesia. It was in the presence of the ecclesia. It was manifested and directed to all. Remember what we read in Romans chapter 16, Gaius mine host, and of the whole ecclesia. Whereas Diotrephes, whose name ironically appears to come from the word trepho, meaning to nourish or feed. And he was a lover of preeminence, as the word philokro teoon means. He was a lover of preeminence. He loves to have the preeminence. It's all one word in Greek. A lover of preeminence, who nourished his own ambition. And hence, one a lover, agape, of the brethren. The other, philio, from philokro teoon. Who loved philio to be first. A lover of the brethren, and a lover of preeminence, of his own pride. And so, these then are the seeming circumstances of this epistle before us as we look at it tonight, brothers and sisters. John, the sole and aging apostle, has returned, probably to Ephesus. He has seen the schism in the Corinthian ecclesia, and he has sent brethren to sustain them and to exhort them in the way of Christ, that he is not divided. Christ is not divided. There is one God. There is one Lord Jesus anointed, one baptism, one hope of our calling. He's not divided. Diotrephes tries to cut off from the ecclesia fellowship or any kind of fellowship. He cuts off from any kind of ecclesial fellowship at all those whose singular offence is that they don't belong to his faction and didn't yield to his schism and exclusion. Look at verse 10 again. Wherefore, if I come, I will remember his deeds which he doeth, prating against us with malicious words, and not content therewith, neither doth he himself receive the brethren, and forbiddeth them that would, and casteth them out of the ecclesia, whom Gaius received, demonstrating the love and the hospitality of those who were of power to build up that ecclesia. And they were going to build it up by the words that were invested in them by the apostle, building up the ecclesia in faith and good works. John wouldn't have sent anybody any more than the brethren at Antioch would have sent anybody less than Paul and Barnabas. They came not to furnish their own pride, but in meekness instructing those that opposed themselves. Gaius delighted in those who were thus disposed, brothers and sisters. He delighted in those who were thus disposed, who could prosper the ecclesia in the way of salvation, could lead them on into that way of life. As we should look well to those brothers and sisters who are of power to help us in the way towards that final goal, that standing before the tribunal of Christ. Anything that we can partake of, brothers and sisters, that will make that so much easier for us in that day, we should welcome. And so Gaius was thus disposed. This is all that mattered to him, as John himself implies in those words of verse 3 and 4 of this epistle. "For I rejoiced greatly when the brethren came and testified of the truth that is in thee, Gaius, even as thou walkest in truth. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth." No greater joy, brothers and sisters, that he walked in the way of truth. Where is worldly ambition, even when it's manifest within the ecclesia? And there are those brethren, you know, brothers and sisters, that seek some kind of career within the ecclesial structure, some kind of preeminence. And where's that going to be in the day when we stand before the tribunal of Christ, when we'll feel naked before him? Brothers and sisters, these things ought not to be. "If ye did it not unto the least of these my brethren, ye did it not unto me." And you know, brothers and sisters, if anybody had a claim to preeminence in this ecclesia, it was Gaius. It might have been Gaius, who was one of two brethren, singular brethren in the whole of the New Testament. Oh yes, and plus the household of Stephanus, who had they were singularly noteworthy for one thing. Let's turn to the Epistle to the Corinthians and chapter 1. Corinthians, 1st of Corinthians and chapter 1, verse 14. Verse 13, "Is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Or were ye baptized in the name of Paul?" And here he's answering these questions about the schism which has rent this ecclesia in two, maybe more than two. "I thank God that I baptized none of you but Crispus and Gaius, lest any should say that I had baptized in mine own name." And so, brothers and sisters, he is one of two brethren plus the household of Stephanus that were baptized by the Apostle Paul himself. Apostle Paul says, "Besides, I know not whether I baptize any other," and you know these chapters here quite well, and we're absolutely confident of that. And you will know that if Gaius and the others mentioned there were at all full of pride, full of their own importance, full of preeminence in any way, it would have been counterproductive for the Apostle Paul to have mentioned Gaius in this context. And he doesn't. He mentions them, these brethren, in this way, knowing that though he baptized them, they were not schismatic. They didn't cause division, and they sought not after preeminence. Gaius, mine host. And even so long before the time of the writing of the third epistle, this ecclesia at Corinth was rent by schism. Verse 11, "For it hath been declared unto me of you, my brethren, by them which are of the house of Chloe, that there are contentions among you." The house of Chloe, Paul knew, were part of that faction, or part of one of the factions. And indeed, he's virtually saying here, by something he says later in this epistle, he accuses them of tail-bearing. And the contention, the word contention there is the word erides, and that contention, by the end of the epistle, Paul shows the end of contention. Let's turn to chapter 11 of this epistle, brothers and sisters. Chapter 11 and verse 17. "Now in this that I declare unto you, I praise you not that ye come together, not for the better, but for the worse. For first of all, when ye come together in the ecclesia, I hear that there be divisions, schisma. So the contention has now become a schism, that there be divisions among you, and I partly believe it. Didn't believe it in entirety. He says he partly believes it, knowing that what he heard from the house of Chloe and others was six of one and half a dozen of the other. Petty jealousies and household divisions, which seem always to be endemic in the ecclesias, as it was in Israel of old. And so, brothers and sisters, at the time of the writing of the third epistle, we would suggest that Corinth, the epistle who the writing of John there was directed to, was also in a state of schism, caused by Diotrephes. But at this stage, we'd like to, with the few minutes left in this first session, we'd like to change tack a little. We might ask why the second and third epistles were written at all, what purpose they serve. Why are they recorded by the Spirit, in other words, that those who should come after should be able to read them? Why? You see, brothers and sisters, these epistles occupy a definitive place in the canon of inspired scripture in the New Testament. They contribute their own special element to the stock of divine truth and practice. They're not concerned with the miraculous and the charismatic and other direct manifestations of divine power. They're not concerned about that at all. They lead us to consider everyday life in the ecclesia. That's their hallmark, their everyday life in the ecclesia, which is regular and unexciting, without inspiration and without charisma. The teaching of these two epistles is direct and practical at a time when manifestations of the Spirit gifts were in the decline. And the calm strength of the aged apostle can be seen in his words in this epistle, which are grave and reserved. In this epistle, let's turn back to it, shall we? The third epistle, the word God occurs twice. Verse 11, beloved, follow not that which is evil, but that which is good. He that doeth good is of God. That is, he bears those characteristics which have been revealed. But he that doeth evil hath not seen God. And you know, the words Jesus or Christ are not mentioned at all. Not mentioned at all in this epistle. And yet, what a weight of glory there is, brethren and sisters. A weight of glory and meaning in the implied words of verse 7. Because that for his name's sake they went forth, taking nothing of the Gentiles. For the sake of the name, in Greek, the name, tol anomatos, the name. That name which is above every name, even Yahshua, to whom every knee should bow and every tongue should confess to the glory of Yahweh. Why? Philippians chapter 2, brothers and sisters. Philippians chapter 2, especially in the light of those contrary influences that we've seen in this ecclesia to whom John wrote. Philippians chapter 2 and verse 5. Let this mind be in you, which was also in the anointed Jesus, who being in the form of God, thought not robbery to become equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself, and became obedient unto death, even the death of the stake. Wherefore God hath highly exalted him, and given him that name which is above every name. For the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister, and to give his life a ransom for many. To give his life a ransom for many. A minister, a servant, and one that brought forth light and life out of obscurity and darkness. Reading those words then, brethren and sisters, what an indictment. What an indictment against Diotrephes. And what a testimony to Gaius, the host of those visiting brethren. The contribution made by these two epistles adds its own special slant and weight to that of the other writers of, or the other writings of the of New Testament authors. In the second epistle, there's presented the idea before us of a fixed statement of faith, a standard or norm by which every teacher in his doctrine was to be tested. For instance, the second epistle and verse 9. Whosoever transgresseth and abideth not in the doctrine of Christ hath not seen God, or hath not God. He that abideth in the doctrine of Christ hath both the Father and the Son. If there come any unto you and bring not this doctrine, receive him not into your house, neither bid him God's speed. And brothers and sisters, there was moral contamination in heresy and moral guilt, not only on the part of those who preached it, but on the part of those who permitted its passage, unchallenged and unchecked. And in the third epistle, the ecclesia is warned against ambitious aspirants to ecclesiastical primacy. Verse 9, I wrote unto the ecclesia, but Diotrephes, who loveth to have the preeminence, a lover of preeminence, philopro teoon, loving preeminence, loving to be first, among them receiveth us not. The prototype, brethren and sisters, we see here in these two epistles, these faults within the ecclesias that the Apostle John has earmarked, has highlighted, these are indeed is the prototype of the Roman system of religion, which is even at this stage starting within the ecclesias. Based upon 1, rejection of apostolic teaching; 2, primacy, loving to be first, having the preeminence; 3, aloofness; 4, rejection and excommunication of those who sought after the truth; 5, the total moral guilt it has acquired by schismatic resistance to the doctrine of the apostles; and 6, to be completely overcome in heresy whose roots are based in the evil Greco-Roman world of the first century. And we see there, brothers and sisters, in embryo, the Catholic system. That's why those two epistles have been placed before us, that we might know the evil intent that was lurking below the surface. Indeed, it erupted above the surface, didn't it, in the case of the third epistle. And, brethren and sisters, although it describes this evil intent behind the ecclesia or within their midst, through it, the meekness and the gentleness of the Anointed One has prevailed, and the divine authority vested in the apostles. But in the second address, we, God willing, we shall see the Israelitish nature of this epistle, the conflict between the mind of the spirit and the thinking of the flesh, and the authority vested in this gentle apostle.